This is KDNK at 641. It is time for your KDNK local newscast for this Friday morning, October 21st. I'm Steve Cole. Last night, KDNK broadcast live from the Mayoral Candidate Forum at the 3rd Street Center in partnership with the Sopra Sun and Carbondale Chamber of Commerce. We will bring you highlights on Monday, and the entire audio is now posted on KDNK.org if you want to get a jump. KDNK's Amy Haddon Marsh has this report of last night's Carbondale Planning and Zoning Commission meeting.
Last night, after the mayoral candidate forum, the Carbondale Planning and Zoning Commission met at Town Hall. Only 4 of 8 members attended the meeting, plus Planning Director Janet Buck. The hearing was to consider an amendment to the town's Unified Development Code, or UDC, to allow short-term rental units in all zone districts. Currently, they are not allowed within PUDs. The discussion between the trustees and the P&Z dates back to last spring. But in August, trustees said they did not want requirements other than a sales tax for owner-occupied rentals and that non-owner-occupied rentals should be treated the same as a bed and breakfast. At last night's meeting, Buck raised questions about B&Bs, such as how they differ from owner-occupied short-term rentals and whether they should be eliminated from the UDC. Buck proposed several amendments to the development code, stating that it does not have any regulations for short-term rentals. But this raised more questions about taxes, tracking, regulations, public safety, parking, and health standards for B&B kitchens. Glenwood Springs resident and attorney Jim New, who owns property, including a short-term rental unit in Carbondale, offered assistance to the commission and urged them to make the same regulations town-wide. Janet Buck requested time to research how other towns handle short-term rentals. The public hearing was continued until November 17th. For KDNK, I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
This year's proposed Amendment 71, or Raise the Bar, asks voters to decide whether making amendments to the state constitution should be made more difficult. But a wide array of groups oppose it, as Kelsey Ray reports for the Colorado Independent. For this week's news brief, Amy Haddon Marsh talks to Kelsey Ray about the amendment, why so many different groups oppose it, why the oil and gas industry supports it, and why it may be raising the bar a little too high.
Kelsey Ray, thanks very much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In your article, Diverse Coalition Unites Against Raise the Bar, you start off the piece with the image of the Trojan horse, stating that the Vote No on Amendment 71 campaign believes the initiative to be just that. Why?
Yeah, they have this giant wooden horse that they trail around with them, which is pretty great. I think Representative Joe Salazar probably summarized it pretty well when he called it, quote, a big shiny object meant to lure you into giving up your own power. I think opponents of Raise the Bar would say that it makes some big promises, protect the Constitution, keep Colorado safe from outside interests, that are kind of hard to argue with. But I think on a very basic level, they would say that the effect it would have on citizens and on grassroots groups is to just take away their ability to make any kind of meaningful change.
Can you describe what Amendment 71 is?
Amendment 71 is an attempt to make it harder to change Colorado's constitution. Any group that wants to make a constitutional amendment would have to get signatures from every single Senate district across the state. There are 35 of them, instead of just being able to get the 100,000 signatures that are currently required.
Why Senate districts? Why not all the counties or all the congressional districts?
I did read about other states that have similar requirements, and they typically use congressional districts, of which there are fewer, or counties. And none of them require that you get them from every single county. And I think that's the real sticking point here, is that by requiring it from every single Senate district instead of, say, half of them or a third or two-thirds of them, you're basically giving any single district veto power.
So
you would have to have a campaign in every single district to try to get the signatures that you want, but the opposition really could just choose one specific district and have an opposition campaign and tell everybody not to sign, and that could end up being just as effective.
I don't understand how this amendment would protect rural Coloradans, which is basically what proponents say. How would it do that?
The argument is that right now, if you want to get 100,000 signatures, the easiest way to do that is to just hang out on the 16th Street Mall, Pearl Street in Boulder, and basically these Front Range cities get to have all the power. So this would require signatures from every single Senate district. So in theory, you could say, all right, that gives rural people a voice. But I think opponents would say that it's so hard to get that requirement at all that it essentially silences everybody.
Well, if somebody in Denver County wanted to put something on initiative on the ballot, they would have to hit all 35 districts. And so would somebody who lived maybe in rural Garfield County. They'd have to go to all 35 Senate districts as well. So it doesn't seem to me that there would be really that much difference.
I guess the difference is right now, you could say that the majority of people who are signing petitions live in Front Range cities. And that's just because the number makes sense. That's where the people are. It's the highest population. So this would make the same bar for everybody. And opponents would say it's an impossibly high bar. Traveling around 35 different Senate districts trying to get signatures would just cost a lot of money and take a lot of time.
And so that sort of probably answers my next question as to why the Vote No campaign says that only rich people will benefit if the initiative passes.
Yeah, basically what they're saying is that the cost of running a campaign under Raise the Bar becomes so high that only rich people, rich groups, and wealthy industries can afford to run them. It's a pretty well-known, I'd say, fact among anyone who tries to run a ballot initiative campaign that no matter how much grassroots support you have to pay signature gatherers. And so in the end, it does come down to money.
It seems that there is a broad spectrum of groups and people against Initiative 71 that includes both progressives and conservatives.
Groups that oppose Raise the Bar include environmentalists, the Latino community, gun rights activists, and labor unions. It's opposed by the Denver Democrats and the Denver Republicans. And also pro-lifers and pro-choicers oppose it. And I guess what you could say that all of these groups have in common is that they would want to be able to, you know, use direct democracy to enact change.
You write that Sam Gilchrist of the AFL-CIO said that the Raise the Bar campaign could not collect 2% of signatures from all 35 Senate districts, which is basically what they would like to require everybody else to do. Did the Raise the Bar campaign actually go to all 35 districts and they couldn't get enough signatures, or did they not even attempt to go to the 35 districts?
So that's an important distinction, right? The Raise the Bar campaign says they did try to get signatures from every district, which I think shows some initiative, you know, so that's good. But the downside of that is that they tried. They spent almost $1 million in signature collection, and they were not able to do it. They say they got signatures from every district and that they were able to break that 2% in about 7 of the rural districts, but they couldn't confirm to me that they were able to get that 2% they needed, which shows that essentially they couldn't meet their own bar. Well, or certainly would cost probably even more than $1 million to do it.
Right. So getting down to the money here, you write that 75% of the $4.1 million that the Raise the Bar campaign has came from oil and gas industry. Why?
I'd say that the oil and gas industry is giving money because this matters to them, and that they're giving the most money because they can afford it and they have a ton of money. The oil and gas industry, and specifically a group called Protect Colorado, had $15 million ready, lined up, to fight the anti-fracking initiatives. Those ultimately didn't make the ballot, and I think what we're seeing is they're taking a lot of that money and putting it towards supporting Raise the Bar. So if it were really hard for citizens to create initiatives like to ban fracking, that's obviously really, really good for the oil and gas industry. One less thing they don't have to worry about. So I think the stake that the oil and gas industry has in this is pretty obvious. But that said, there are plenty of other groups that support it that just haven't given nearly as much money.
Well, Kelsey Ray, reporter for the Colorado Independent, thanks very much for taking the time and thanks for your great work.
Hey, thank you so much.
That does it for this week's News Brief on KDNK. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
You can find Kelsey Ray's work at ColoradoIndependent.com. We will link to her story at KDNK. Sometimes when news happens around the state, our partners in the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Network share updates. This one's a doozy. Peterson Air Force Base officials say 150,000 gallons of water containing perfluorinated compounds were mistakenly discharged into the sewer system earlier this month. Our partner station KRCC's Jake Brownell has more.
Officials say the water was being held in a large retention tank in a fire training area on the base. They say they knew the water contained the potentially harmful chemicals and were working on a plan to safely dispose of it. But sometime earlier this month, the tank was mistakenly emptied into the municipal sewer system. Peterson Air Force Base Environmental Chief Fred Brooks says discharging the tank is not a simple process.
There's at least two valves that have to be turned on, and then the electrical control for this is above ground and separate from that, so it's at least a three-step process.
A spokesperson for Colorado Springs Utilities says the water then passed through a wastewater treatment plant and eventually made its way into Fountain Creek. Current treatment processes at the CSU plant don't remove PFCs from wastewater. An Air Force investigation into the incident is underway. For 91.5 KRCC News, I'm Jake Brownell in Colorado Springs.
In the Can't Get There From Here department, Highway 133 is still closed in both directions between McClure Pass Summit and Paonia Reservoir due to a massive rock slide early Wednesday morning. We'll have a little more on that in a few minutes. But if you don't want to go the long way around, want to wait, they may have it cleaned up by sometime tomorrow on Saturday.